From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As we face the new work and school year, many of us are still seeped in last season's clutter. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, some advice on how to dig out and straighten up. We'll hear from organizing expert Julie Morgenstern, author of the bestseller Organizing from the Inside Out. The new film Earth opens today, based on a novel by Bapsi Sidhwa about the partition of India. We'll hear from Sidhwa, who was a child when her country was partitioned. She remembers it as a terrifying time. And film critic John Powers reviews the latest ghost story, Stir of Echoes, starring Kevin Bacon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has arrived in New Zealand for the annual summit of Asia-Pacific leaders who will confer about the violence in East Timor. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports from Auckland.
Over the past 24 hours, leaders of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, have shifted their attention from the economic issues that bring them together every year to the crisis in East Timor. As President Clinton prepared to leave for Auckland, he used harsh language toward Jakarta for the way it's dealt with East Timor security. He said the unchecked violence that's followed the territory's vote to break away from Indonesia is simply unacceptable. During the trip, he and Australian Prime Minister John Howard discussed proposals for an international peacekeeping force if Indonesia fails to bring the situation under control. President Clinton has pledged some form of U.S. support for such a force. But General Wiranto, head of the Indonesian military, now says Jakarta might allow such a force in the future, but not at this time. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Auckland.
A judge in Charlotte, North Carolina, has declared the school district integrated after 30 years of court-ordered busing. Judge Robert Potter said the state must stop using race as a factor in all its programs. The school board wanted to continue its extensive busing system, arguing that it still has not ended discrimination in the 100,000-student school system. Today's decision came in a suit filed by the parents of a white and Hispanic third grader, claiming their daughter had been denied admission to one of the city's magnet schools because of her race. An attorney for black parents says they'll appeal the ruling. 90 people have now died and more than 250 have been injured in this week's explosion at a Moscow apartment building. Some politicians say the explosion was a terrorist attack, but investigators still haven't determined a cause. David McGuffin reports.
Rescue workers have finished pulling the bodies from the wreckage of a 9-story Moscow apartment building flattened in a Wednesday night explosion. Investigators say they are looking into 3 possible causes for the tragedy: a gas leak, a terrorist attack, or an accidental blast set off by explosives kept in a store on the ground floor. On national television, the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin was cautious about laying blame for the attack, but Putin warned that if it was a terrorist action, then Russia is facing a cunning, sly, and bloodthirsty enemy. Moscow mayor and presidential hopeful Yuri Lushkov is laying the blame for the attack squarely on Islamic rebels, who are fighting Russian troops in the south of the country. A bomb attack in a Moscow mall 10 days ago has left people in the Russian capital increasingly wary about the threat of terrorism. For NPR News, I'm David McGuffin in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down by 51 points today to end the day at 11,028. Advances in led declines by a small margin in active trading. This is NPR. A jury in Los Angeles has acquitted Football Hall of Famer Jim Brown of threatening to kill his wife, but found him guilty of vandalizing her car. Prosecutors accused the former Cleveland Browns star of threatening to snap his wife's neck and smashing her car windows with a shovel during an argument at their Hollywood home in June. Hurricane Floyd continues to gather strength in the Atlantic. It's now located about 400 miles east-northeast of Puerto Rico. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Floyd is moving northwest at approximately 12 miles per hour. It's expected to turn slightly more to the west by late tomorrow. This will take it well clear of the Leeward Islands in the Caribbean, but because of strong winds and bands of rain extending well out from the center of the storm, a tropical storm watch is in effect for several islands, including Antigua, Barbuda, Anguilla, and St. Martin. Right now, Floyd is sporting sustained winds of 80 miles per hour with higher gusts. but the storm is expected to grow stronger over the next 24 hours. The National Weather Service is recommending that residents of the Bahamas and the southeastern United States keep track of Floyd, since its course may eventually threaten those areas. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Three major oil companies have reportedly agreed in principle to pay about $155 million to settle charges that they underpaid oil royalties to the federal government. According to reports in today's Dallas Morning News and the Wall Street Journal, Chevron would pay about $95 million, while BP, Amoco, and Conoco would pay about $30 million apiece. 18 large oil companies have been accused of underpaying royalties. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us are facing the new season up to our ears in the clutter and mess left over from last season. Take me, for instance. There's piles of paper on my desk, bulging file drawers filled with material I probably don't need, books on the floor blocking my path to my desk while CDs are falling off their shelves. Julie Morgenstern is reassuring. She says those of us who don't know how to organize don't lack an innate ability. We just never learned how. That's where she comes in. Since 1989, she's run a business called Taskmasters, which helps people organize their homes and offices and stay organized. She's also the author of the bestseller Organizing from the Inside Out. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded last December. I asked her about some of the typical mistakes we make when we try to get organized.
Getting organized is a very overwhelming chore. People don't know where to start, and they don't know how to manage their way through it. So often they sort of hack away at it haphazardly and frenetically and make no progress, and that's very discouraging. For example, a lot of times the first thing people do when they want to get organized is they go out shopping for containers. They think that the right basket or bin or planner or divider or sorter is going to solve the problem. And they can invest lots of money, I mean hundreds to thousands of dollars in furniture that stores and getting closets rebuilt. And if they haven't stepped back first and really analyzed and what I call strategized their solution, they usually spend that money for naught. And, you know, within weeks, the place is a mess again.
So you need a system before you do anything else.
You need a system. You need to analyze it. You need to really figure out what you've got, what's important to you, where you're trying to get to, and what's the purpose of the system that you're designing. You can't skip over the purpose of it. It's not just to be neat, and it's not just to be quicker about things. It's what do you specifically want to accomplish? What are the tasks that you're trying to accomplish? What are your goals in your job? What are your goals in your life? And if you define those first, you can then design a system to support that.
I completely agree with you, but this is where I start to stumble in figuring out a system. It's hard to figure out a good system that's going to organize everything and that you'll be able to actually follow through on.
Yeah, well, you need to ask yourself some critical questions first. And I think people don't necessarily know what questions to ask, or they're impatient and they want instant results. First question is, looking in your space right now, ask yourself what's working. Because usually there are, no matter how chaotic it is, a few systems underneath the pile and the rubbles that are working for you. And if you can identify them, number one, you can preserve them so you're not unnecessarily disoriented, which often happens when you get organized as you overhaul everything and then you start losing things again and it becomes a problem. So that helps. And also you can study why it works for you, and that will give you a lot of insight into what kind of system you need to design for yourself. Is it the color of the container? Is it the location of it? Is it the size? You know, what is it about that system that works? And build upon that. So it's the very first question that you ask. The second question that you ask is, what's not working? Now that you know what's working, the really long list is, what's not working? And you need to make a thorough list of everything that's not working. And sometimes I recommend people just keep a log, a notepad by their desk or in their living room or whatever the problem space is for a week. And every time they can't find something, don't know where to put something, stumble over something, whenever there's a problem, write it down. And that becomes a master list of everything you need to fix in order to fully solve the problem.
Let's quickly get through the other questions.
Okay, what's working, what's not working, what's most essential to you? And that's a very important question, because that's the what are your priorities? What is it that you really have to accomplish in your job? What is it that you want out of your living room? What are the most essential items? We use approximately 20% of what we own. We refer to about 20% of what we have in our filing system. So sit down and really try to think about what those essentials are before you dig through the piles, and it will help the sorting and purging process go much faster later. Next question is, why do you want to get organized? It's very important to write your answers down now while you're at the height of your motivation, so that later when you're going through the laborious job of making decisions, you have a sort of motivation coaching tool to keep you going, so you don't forget why you started this process when you get discouraged. And the last question is, what's holding you back? Clutter and piles and messes can have many different causes, and it's critical that you pinpoint what's causing the clutter. Why are you accumulating all this stuff? Why is it that you can't create a system? Is it just sort of a mechanical, I don't know how to set it up? Is there some psychological resistance? And there's quite a bit of that that we have. A lot of psychological stakes in keeping the chaos, even though we prefer to be organized. And sometimes they're just external realities working against us, and you need to identify them in order to get beyond them.
You suggest when you're starting to organize and to create a new system, the first thing you have to do is sort through your stuff, you know, after you've asked yourself all the questions and decided. Mm-hmm. So you're sorting through your stuff, and then you're throwing out the stuff that you don't need.
Right.
Okay. Again, I agree with this in principle. Throwing out the stuff is really hard. Now, you suggest you use 20% of your stuff, and the other 80% of your stuff you usually don't use.
Yeah.
But there's that voice in your head saying, but tomorrow I might need it. Tomorrow this file might save the day. Tomorrow this shirt that I haven't worn in 7 years might be just the thing.
Right.
Tomorrow
right.
This insignificant object might have huge sentimental value to me, so I'd better keep it. This is what I always go through. How heartless are you in throwing things out?
I'm not heartless at all. I probably take the opposite approach. When I work with clients, and actually I encourage people, if they're not ready to throw things out, that is the one expendable step in the organizing process. You can get organized without throwing a thing out. The key to organizing is to identify what's important and make it accessible to you. There is no point in saving all this stuff that might be valuable, and then you can't find it when you need it, or you don't even remember that you have it when you need it, which is the common problem. So if you're really hesitant to get rid of anything, and it all is really important to you, then just organize it, sort it, and give everything a home so that you can find it when you need it.
But there's some things you should obviously throw out, right?
Oh, yeah.
You have, in every chapter, you have a list of no-brainers, things you should definitely just throw out. Run through some of the no-brainers for us.
Well, no-brainers in an office would be, you know, multiple drafts or past drafts of a document that, you know, you kept changing. Get rid of all the old drafts. You already rejected the material in them. You don't need to save them in case you go back and want to rewrite the article or rewrite the letter and tap into those ideas. A lot of times we save incredible amounts of, like, literature and brochure of things that we're considering buying or services that we may use. And I say throw out all of the literature and just keep the source. In a Rolodex, you can have a list of the potential sources you may use. And if you're ready to buy, then you just call them up and have them send you another brochure. I mean, why should you be their library? A lot of times we buy things in some moment of madness and a different personality comes out of us, and then we take it home and we never really like it. We never use it. I don't think you should hold on to things because you spent money on them. I think you should really hold on to things that really have value to you. Things that you either use or love is what you should keep. The things that you used to use or might use someday should go. You do have to be fairly brutal. I often tell people to think of all that stuff. I might need this someday, I used to use it, it was really valuable, gee, I spent so much money on it, I know I haven't used it yet, but I should. All those things are basically a barrier between you and the things that you really need to use and get to.
My guest is organizing expert Julie Morgenstern, author of Organizing from the Inside Out. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is organizing expert Julie Morgenstern, author of Organizing from the Inside Out. Now, one of your general principles in organizing is don't zigzag. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, when you're going to organize any space, a lot of times people just sort of try to take the whole thing in at once, and they start in one corner or one room, and they start sorting through their stuff and find something that belongs elsewhere. Say you're on your desktop and you find a book that belongs on the bookshelf. Well, you go to take the book to the bookshelf. You look at the bookshelf and you say, oh, my gosh, this is horrible. There's no place to put the book. I'm going to start organizing the books. So you start pulling the bookshelf apart, and say you find a file and you go to put it in the file drawer. You open the file drawer, you scream, you say, I've got to organize these files. And you start that and you start zigzagging all over your space, starting and stopping a million different projects. And after 3 or 4 hours of that, you turn around, you see no progress. You actually see a worse mess than when you started, and there is no reward for your efforts. And it is incredibly discouraging. So instead of working that way, and this is the technique, I will tell you, I developed this almost as a survival tool as a business person. When I started my business, if people are paying me to organize them and they don't see progress after 4 hours working with me, they're not going to have me back, right? So I developed this technique called visible dramatic results. You start in one section and you complete it before moving on to the next. Then you go to the next section, you complete it before moving on to the next. If you find anything that belongs elsewhere, put it in a belongs elsewhere box or crate. And then at the end of your organizing session, you can take that little box and deliver it to it, you know, all these items to their various homes. And when you come back into your space, you will see visible, dramatic results for your efforts. You'll see two sections of the room completely sorted and cleared out. And it will encourage you to continue the project because you've got to see those results in order to be motivated to continue.
Okay, now you've got an order. You say first you sort through things and you put like things in like piles.
Correct.
Then you throw out what you don't need. Then you assign everything a home. And then you put things in containers or shelves.
Right.
And then what?
And then you do what I call equalize. And that's adjusting your system and maintaining your system so that it stays current with your priorities, so that you're constantly preventing it from getting away from you. And equalizing or maintaining is something that takes certain daily ritual. You've got to, on a daily basis, spend 10 minutes at the end of every day, for example, putting everything away from your desk so that when you come in to work in the morning, you can hit the ground running. And in your home, make a commitment that before you go to bed or before you leave a room, you put everything back where it belongs. And it should only take between 3 and 5 minutes in any organized space to clean up, no matter how messy it gets. And then once or twice a year, you want to sort of refresh or tune up your system. You know, possessions grow like weeds, and you have to go through again and get rid of all the excess to stay on top of it.
Okay, let's tackle an office. Let's say that one of the things that your office is overwhelmed by is papers, memos, letters, miscellaneous things. Some of these you need to file. Some of these you could throw out. One of the things that trips you up right from the start is, how do you know what it is or if you need to keep it or if it's important unless you've read it? And then you can get into this like marathon reading session that would never end.
Right.
What's your advice?
Well, my advice is that the first goal is actually to design a filing system. Most offices that are stacked up with papers just don't have a user-friendly, easy filing system. So your goal is actually to overhaul your filing system and create a system that makes getting information, retrieving information, very easy. Remember, a filing system is about retrieval, not storage, which is the opposite of the way most people think. I got to store all this stuff. Where do I put it to get it off my desk? Actually, you want to think of filing as putting things away so that you can retrieve them when you need them quickly. You can always purge the contents of a file folder later. The most important thing is to figure out what categories of files you have.
I'll tell you what I think one of my big problems is in my office and in my home when it comes to filing papers. You get something, you're not really sure what you want to do with it, so you just put it in a pile to be worried about later, and suddenly you have piles and piles of papers to be worried about later. And then you have to take like an entire day just to get through those piles.
Right. I mean, if papers are stacked on your desktop, it's usually because either there's no home for them. Like you said, something comes in and it doesn't really have a category yet. You're not sure what you're going to do with it. You don't know where it belongs. It doesn't have a home. So it just sits on your desktop. Or you leave it up because it's something that you want to do. You don't
right,
want to forget.
Yes, right. It needs to be taken care of. Exactly.
Right. And those piles, as you said, just pile up and pile up and pile up. And we just ignore everything under the top layer of those piles after a short time. It's like it sort of becomes visual muzak. You know, it just blends in and you zone it out. And you don't even notice those reminders. I recommend that if you can get, as I said, more files within arm's reach of your desk chair so you don't have to get out of your chair to file. File every piece of paper, no matter what its stage of completion, and keep a to-do list either in your daily planner or even on just a notepad on your desk telling you what it is that you have to do. And just put a little, you know, F with a circle next to it that says, you know, there's a file for this. And when you're ready to deal with that task, you go to the file and you pull out the paper. So if you're in the middle of something, you can file it and just write, you know, got to finish proposal, got to finish letter, consider such and such, you know, bid, and file it no matter, as I said, what its stage of completion.
Some people, well, I guess, you know, pack rats is the common word that's used. Some people just psychologically seem inclined to hold on to things. And to other people, it doesn't matter. They could just throw things out. Do you get a lot into the psychology of your clients whose homes and offices you're organizing and why some people need to hold on to things and others don't?
I do. And what's interesting is I don't play psychologist. I don't go in and analyze them. But I do quietly sort of assess what I think is going on. And then I will adjust the way I work with them to accommodate that. For example, I think some people really have a need for abundance. They have a lot of stuff because they need to have a lot of stuff around them. It gives them a certain feeling of wealth or richness or comfort or security because maybe they grew up poor, or maybe they grew up deprived in some other way, whether it was material things or they didn't have enough of something growing up. So they fill their lives with lots of stuff. And if somebody is like that, if I notice a client is like that, I will not push them to get rid of anything. I will just work with them to almost celebrate the abundance by displaying it, sorting and organizing it. People who are like this often have all kinds of containers that they keep trying to get things sorted into. And, I mean, I did this with a client who had an incredible amount of arts and craft supplies. Could have opened a nursery school. And she had two kids. And she didn't need that much, but I could tell that this was really important to her. So we just cleared out a whole closet, and we kept it all, and we sorted it and labeled it. And there was one bin for pom-poms and another one for sequins and another one for yarn and huge amounts of everything. And we celebrated it, and she loved that. And, you know, she would go into that closet and just feel good every time she would look in there and see all her stuff so well organized. And eventually she started to pare it down because she saw once it was grouped that she didn't need that much of each thing. So that's a way that you would tune in. Other times, I mean, sometimes clutter actually serves as a cushion between a person and the outside world. When it gets so bad that you cannot have people over in your house, you haven't had anybody visit you for years because it's so cluttered, or your office, people can't come in. The clutter is sometimes just used as an excuse to keep people out, for whatever reasons, for whatever psychological reasons. And if someone has sort of been retreating behind the chaos for years, I will work with them very slowly. And we will just do one space at a time and let them live with it for months before we move on to the next and the next and the next. So that maybe over the course of a year, they can start to deal with a more open environment. And as far as I'm concerned, they can stay retreated. But if you're going to be retreated, you might as well be in a nice space, you know, just keep your door bolted and don't let anybody in, but be in a nicer environment. You don't need to use the clutter as the excuse. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you need to take that process more slowly. Other times it's just a distraction. You know, people just keep it. They don't want to deal with more difficult issues or difficult projects. So they always have a pile to sort through, a closet to clean, a room to organize, and it fills their mind on a daily basis with, gosh, I've got to get organized. Gosh, I've got to get organized. And it's distracting them from dealing with whatever they are really not ready to, career issues or marriage issues or whatever, personal issues. So, again, it's important to sort of identify what stake you may have in the clutter so that you can deal with it a little more directly and not use disorganization as your excuse.
I remember when I was in grade school that all the teachers who were, by the way, very neat, used to say, a disorganized desk is a sign of a disorganized mind. Having seen your share of disorganized desks, do you think that that's true?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I really don't. Some people are very visual people who are very organized but very messy. If you know what's in all of those piles and you can get your hands on any piece of paper when you need it, you're organized. It may be messy, but you're organized. And you need to stay strong on that. You know, don't let the powers that be come down and say, gee, you got to clean this mess up. I've refused jobs at corporations where they said, you got to clean up the mess because it's embarrassing to clients. The art department is so messy. But the people are doing their job and they're highly productive and they know where everything is in every pile. And I say, look, don't spend your money on me. Invest in some beautiful screens and hide those people and let them do their work in their chaotic style of organization. So you really have to define organization from a functional point of view. Are you functional? Can you find what you need when you need it? Not how does it look? You cannot tell by looking at any space whether it is organized or not, ever, ever. 10 years in this business, and I can't tell when I walk into a space whether it's organized or not. I've had clients call me in, oh, I'm so disorganized, I can't find anything, it's such a mess, and I walk into a beautifully appointed home or office. No clutter, clear surfaces, everything is gorgeous. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to earn my fee here? You know, there's nothing I can say. And then we open up the drawers and we open up the cabinets and, oh, there is no system. Things never go back in the same place. It's just a style where on the surface it looks organized, but underneath it's not. So you can't tell by looking at a space whether it's organized or not.
Well, Julie, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Julie Morgenstern is the author of Organizing from the Inside Out and the founder of the professional organizing firm Taskmasters. Our interview was recorded last December. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Scholastic, publisher of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban by J.K. Rowling, the third magical book set at Hogwarts, available wherever books are sold. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. Additional support from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film Earth opens today, based on a novel by Pakistani writer Bapsi Sidhwa about the partition of India. Coming up, Sidhwa shares her memories of the terrifying violence of that era. And John Powers reviews the new supernatural movie Stir of Echoes, starring Kevin Bacon.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier this year, India and Pakistan moved closer to nuclear war. The new movie, Earth, is about the partition of India. The film is set in 1947, after England pulled out and the country was divided into predominantly Hindu India and predominantly Muslim Pakistan. The movie is adapted from the novel Cracking India by Bapsi Sidhwa, one of the first writers from Pakistan to be published internationally. She was a women's rights activist and social worker in Pakistan and was her country's representative to the Asian Women's Congress in 1975. She's currently living in Houston. Sidhwa was 9 at the time of the partition, and she remembers the atmosphere of violence and betrayal as Muslims, Hindus, Parsis, and Sikhs fought among themselves. As a Parsi, she was part of a minority group. The Parsi religion has under 500,000 followers in the whole world. The novel is semi-autobiographical, told from the perspective of an 8-year-old Parsi girl. I spoke with Sidhwa in 1991 after the novel was published. Here's a short reading.
There is much disturbing talk. India is going to be broken. Can one break a country? And what happens if they break it where our house is? Or crack it further up on Waris Road. How will I ever get to Godmother's then? I ask cousin. Rubbish, she says. No one's going to break India. It's not made of glass. I ask Aya. They'll dig a canal, she ventures. This side for Hindustan and this side for Pakistan. If they want two countries, that's what they'll have to do. Crack India with a long canal. Gandhi, Jinnah, Nehru, Mountbatten are names I hear, and I become aware of religious differences. It is sudden. One day, everybody is themselves, and the next day, they are Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, Christian. People shrink, dwindling into symbols. Aya is no longer just my all-encompassing Aya. She is also a token, a Hindu.
Were you frightened when the country was partitioned?
As a child, I have memories of chants, of mobs chanting in the distance, which were very threatening sounds. I felt they threatened the people I held dear. And I saw fires. It wasn't like a fire display to me. It really was threatening. It was like blood was splashed in the sky. And, of course, all the time, there was talk around me of what was happening to our friends and neighbors, who were at that time Hindu and Sikh, who were leaving, and new refugees arriving. And I saw dead bodies on my Waris Road where I lived.
That's pretty terrifying.
As a child, yes, these sounds more than anything else terrified me.
In your novel, Cracking India, Aya, who is the nursemaid of the main character, the woman who cares for the child, she is kind of destroyed at the end by Muslims because she is a Hindu in Muslim Pakistan. Did you know people who were in that position, people who were close to you?
Not people who were close to me, but I grew up with stories about what happened to so-and-so's sister, mother, daughter, brother, father. Now, these were accounts recited by Muslim refugees because I was in Lahore. What did happen, one of the most terrible aspects of the partition was that hundreds of thousands of women were kidnapped, Hindu women and Sikh women by Muslims and Muslim women by Hindus and Sikhs. It's sort of very true of our part of the world that when you have to celebrate a victory, the victors do so on the body of a woman. And when you want to get rid of the feeling of humiliation at a defeat, there again you humiliate your enemy's women by raping them, etc. So the women were the major targets when it came to power play, humiliation, and celebration in this part of the world. So it was Hindu, Muslim, Sikh women, all of who suffered.
When you say they were kidnapped, where were they taken?
They were kidnapped by individuals, taken into their homes, raped, and then sold for 10 rupees each, 20 rupees each, which is less than a dollar, People would be shouting in the streets, apparently, that zanana for sale, zana for sale. You know that women are being sold, and that's the price, 10 rupees for a woman.
When you became a woman, did you meet women who had been kidnapped and sold years before?
I may have met them, but you know, this is something it's considered so dishonorable and so defiling that women would not openly talk about it. Other women would whisper about it. And as a child, I would just catch innuendos and whispers about various women. Where I was living, right next door to me, was a camp for recovered women. These were the women who were kidnapped and then recovered after the partition from various places and brought to these camps. And we as children used to go onto our roof and peek into this camp and look at these very despondent, very poor sort of looking women who didn't talk much. I mean, now with my adult's imagination, I can understand what happened to them. But as a child, I couldn't grasp it. And the sad thing was that a lot of these women were not accepted back by their families because women are supposed to embody honor. You know, they're vessels for honor. And they had been dishonored, so the families didn't want them back into their households. And they were left to fend, you know, by a little training in embroidery and to eke out their lives like that.
You were married at the age of 19. You had three children. You've described yourself as having been an upper-middle-class housewife. Your husband was a businessman. How did you start becoming involved with women's rights?
This is very strange, actually. I read this book, The Female Eunuch, by Germaine Greer. This must be when I was about 25, 26. And I just got up the next day a totally different person, very aggressive, fighting with my husband, having temper tantrums all around, you know, till I decided I shouldn't read books like that. But that gave me an awareness of, well, why was I so submissive and why was I so accepting of taking the secondary place and being so subservient to other people, whether it was my father, mother, or husband. And then I got involved in social work, and gradually my interest in what was happening to women developed, and also my awareness of what was happening to women. I started doing a lot of social work with destitute women's homes, with orphanages, and there I came across instances which really sort of left their stain on me, and I wanted to do something about it.
When you say that you were tired of being subservient to your parents and to your husband, what was the typical middle-class marriage like in Pakistan or at the time? When you talk about subservience, what do you mean?
Well, you know, you are always waiting for your husband. You're more or less a public relations officer to your husband, entertaining for him all the time, taking phone calls. If you go out in a car, you're the one who's waiting endlessly for him to do his work and come in. And you take everything in your stride. You're told this evening so many people are coming, or this day so-and-so is coming, or keep the house ready, we're expecting so many visitors, or at the drop of the hat, let's travel. I mean, you totally sort of sublimate your life for your husband's existence, before that for your parents' existence. These are very little things, and they're not very demanding, but in the end, they accumulate and make for a great demand on one's time.
When you started working with destitute women, did you start becoming aware of the class differences in how women were treated in your country?
Yes, the class difference is there enormously. Among the very poor, the women don't observe the veil, and they work in the fields with the men, except, of course, the village leader's wife. She would observe parda. And her work is not really accounted for in terms of cash. You know, it's free labor. And then when they enter the middle class, interestingly enough, at this point, the woman says, okay, now I'm better off, so I'll go in behind the veil. I'll wear a veil. So it is a status symbol that now my wife does not need to work. We are better off. Then as you get to the much richer classes, then it is the women they don't observe the veil, except if they're in very narrow-minded villages, if their husbands happen to be in the mountain villages, you know, sardars or lords out there. And these women have more or less the freedom of a wife in America, perhaps. So the class does make a great difference. And then when I was working in the destitute women's homes, that's when I became aware what had happened. And it's a strange thing that in Pakistan, men outnumber the women. And in these destitute women's, in the home I was working, there were a lot of women with children. By 19, a woman has produced perhaps 4 children. And if there were 25 women in the home, there would be about 300 men wanting to marry them. And once or twice I realized that perhaps there was something wrong going on, because I saw a dwarf and a very sort of cruel-looking man getting married to a very beautiful young woman of 19. And after that, my friends and I decided that we would interview each of the bridegrooms before something like that happened. And we would interview the bridegrooms to find out what they wanted to marry for. Most of them said, oh, you know, we have so many chickens, we have so many goats, we have so many sacks of wheat, and we have nobody to look after it because my wife died. And then we'd say, but you don't want a wife, you just want a free servant. And if a man showed some inclination to romance, that, look, I've had nobody to arrange my marriage because I've been busy for this reason or that reason, and I would like to get married and have a home of my own, then we would introduce the woman, or at least let them have a look at each other and arrange a marriage between them.
Did you ever wear the veil yourself?
Just as a teenager once, to see what it felt like, I borrowed the veil of one of my friend's mothers, and I walked on the street. It was a sort of an adventure.
So how did it feel?
Well, you know, it's a black thing, and you wear it from top to bottom. You wear it like a skull cap over the head, and it flows right down to your feet. And you feel a little cramped, and it's mysterious because there's netting in front, and you look out through that. The world does seem a little hazier. Your movements are constricted. It certainly, I think, shifts you into a different dimension, into a different world, a more cramped world, constricted world.
We're listening to a 1991 interview with Bapsi Sidhwa. Her semi-autobiographical novel, Cracking India, about the partition of India, has been adapted into the new film, Earth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Pakistani novelist and women's rights activist Bapsi Sidhwa is my guest. You've explained how you went from being a middle-class homemaker to being a women's rights advocate. How did you become a writer? How did you start writing?
I came across it very accidentally. I'd never written before. And when I was about 28, 29, I visited a remote part of Pakistan in the Karakoram Mountains, which is under total tribal jurisdiction. And the tribes there are so locked into the mountains that they really live in the Stone Age still. They literally live in caves. And I heard the story of a young girl who had been married there and had run away from a husband. And these people think a runaway, if a wife runs away, it's an intolerable insult to the husband. And the whole clan was out hunting her, and eventually these infallible hunters, and they found her near the Indus River just before she could be rescued, and they severed her head from her body. When I heard the story in this very beautifully spectacular country in the northern areas, when I came back to Pakistan, I wanted to tell the story of this girl because it did reflect the lives of quite a few women in a way, and I did want to describe the beauty of the scenes I had seen and the tribals. I mean, they were a very romantic people in a way. And I sat down to write what I thought was a short story. And before I knew it, it was turning into a novel. And it became my first novel, which was called The Bride and now is known as The Pakistani Bride.
Do you have a large readership in Pakistan, proportionately?
A very large readership. I would be considered in the absolute bestseller bracket. And I've had the honor of being pirated. And they're very peculiar versions of my books floating around. I don't mind because they sell cheap and they're read, so I'm quite happy.
Are they controversial in your country?
We were expecting The Bride to be controversial, but it wasn't for some reason. And that is why The Croetus was published first, because it was mainly a comedy about the Zoroastrians, which tell you everything about my community as well. But that is the novel which became very controversial, my community to great exception to it. They felt I'd let out secrets that I shouldn't have, and they felt threatened because they were a minority. And it's strange because I'd written it out of great affection. But now that I've received from Pakistan what is a very high civilian award called the Sitara-e Pakistan, my community suddenly accepts me and my writing, you know. You need somebody else to accept you, and then your own community accepts you.
Right, because then you make them look good.
Yeah, maybe. At one point, not so good, and then suddenly good.
What are the things about the status of women that you would still like to see changed in Pakistan?
Oh, my God, a lot of things, most of the things. I would like them, first of all, to get education, to get more control of money, more control of their lives. I certainly would like to see any brother, husband, or father who kills his wife to be just hung. I mean, I'm absolutely for capital punishment when it comes to that. Because brothers and fathers think it is their right, you know, to, if they feel their sister is flirting or has had a secret affair, even with her fiancé, they feel quite justified in killing her. This is, of course, again, we are talking of a class, the peasant class, the poorer classes. And just every sort of zulm, now I'm trying to think, every sort of bullying tactic is used on women, and women are supposed to accept it. And I think I would like to see a lot changed.
Any impressions of the women's movement in the United States?
Yes, of course, I've experienced it, but it's a totally different breed of feminist movement here. Their priorities are different, and their way of handling issues are different. I think there's this huge cultural difference which makes us to react to different things in different ways.
What do you see as the main difference between how the American women's movement handles issues as compared to what you're used to?
It seems to me that they have probably resolved some issues and their priorities have shifted to things which, at this point, because our problems are so enormous, seem to us a little trivial. And we want to be fighting for things where women are in constant physical danger, physically being kidnapped from many parts of the countries to be used in prostitution, and the society turns a blind eye towards it. Whereas some of the issues like, I don't want to really name them because I don't know in what context they fit into the American woman's consciousness. But I know there are some serious problems women face here and they have to keep struggling against it too.
Kidnapping is still an issue in Pakistan?
Yes, because not only kidnapping, but in the northern areas, the races are very white, pale-colored, and they're extremely poor. So people buy girls there, and they put them into prostitution or, you know, all sorts of slavery and things like that. So that is the form of kidnapping. There are other forms of kidnapping, too. I mean, women, for some reason, because of the segregation in the society or whatever the factor, they are, in a way, a desirable commodity. It's the opposite of India, where a woman pays a dowry to get married. In Pakistan, the husband pays the bride's father, this is in the northern areas of Pakistan, to get a bride. So a woman is like a commodity. She's worth money. So women are kidnapped for several reasons.
Are you still married, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Has it been hard to change so much and keep a marriage together?
We've come to a comfortable relationship. Of course, the marriage pattern did change several times, and particularly after we moved to the States. But I think, you know, living in the society we did in Pakistan, naturally a lot of the values of Pakistan had been absorbed, which could not be sustained in America, where the atmosphere for a woman is a lot freer. And I chafed at some of the things. And my husband also changed a lot of his thinking in this different atmosphere. And we have come down to a much more comfortable relationship.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Bapsi Sidhwa, recorded in 1991, her novel Cracking India is the basis of the new film Earth. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film Stir of Echoes. This is Fresh Air. The hit movie The Sixth Sense has some supernatural competition this week with the opening of the movie Stir of Echoes, starring Kevin Bacon. Our film critic John Powers tells us if it measures up.
Apparently, it's not only human beings who are agitated by the upcoming millennium. The unliving are acting up, too. Go to the movies and spooks seem positively inescapable. They're busy in The Haunting, The Blair Witch Project, The Sixth Sense, and now Stir of Echoes, a new ghost story that's better than its pretentious title might suggest. It's based on a novel by Richard Matheson, who seems to be a specialist in raising the dead. He also wrote What Dreams May Come. Here, Kevin Bacon stars as Tom Witzke, a blue-collar guy from Chicago with a loving wife, Maggie, played by Catherine Irby, and a son, Jake, who talks to an invisible little girl. At a party one night, the skeptical Tom lets himself be hypnotized by his ditzy sister-in-law, Lisa. That's Ileana Douglas. When he gets home, he discovers that his doors of perception have been thrown wide open. He now sees the ghost that his son has been talking to, entering a world in which he can no longer tell his everyday reality from nightmarish dreams. Initially freaked, he becomes obsessed by his visions, a change which sends his wife running to her sister, Lisa, for advice.
This is the first time he's been out of the house in a week. He hasn't gone to work. He sleeps like 12 hours a night. He's used up all his sick days. If he doesn't show up on Monday, they're going to start to dock him, and I can't get... I can't get him more than 6 feet from the couch.
Why?
That's where she appeared to him.
Oh. I'm not shocked that there's another woman. Of course, the fact that she's dead gives one pause. We are talking about a ghost here, aren't we, Maggie?
Stir of Echoes was adapted for the screen by David Koepp, best known for writing the script to Jurassic Park. Koepp's own directorial debut, The Trigger Effect, was a dire little number that showed almost no talent as a filmmaker. He's made an enormous step forward here, and for its opening hour, the movie is genuinely chilling, with an eerie hypnotism scene, unnerving time leaps a la Don't Look Now, and sequences that so thoroughly blur the line between dream and reality that were tense with disorientation. As in The Sixth Sense, Koepp anchors his story in a precisely observed physical reality, first creating an absolutely convincing blue-collar neighborhood, then persuading us that it's haunted by mysterious forces. We could live in a place like this, we think, just as we can imagine being an ordinary guy like Tom. It's the veneer of normalcy that makes the movie scary. What makes it disappointing is that the second hour does what horror movies shouldn't do. It fritters away its power by explaining too much. Even worse, the explanation is the usual song and dance about unrighted wrongs that runs through everything from Poltergeist and Candyman to Nightmare on Elm Street. By the end, when the plot is finally resolved with a real gun, Stir of Echoes seems closer to a crime picture than a horror film. It's a sad mistake. For what we want from a story of the supernatural is a sense of the uncanny, the feeling that we're tapping into something inexplicable. One reason for Blair Witch's huge success is its deliberate blankness, its refusal to explain or even show anything. And while The Sixth Sense does provide a kind of explanation at the end, in the form of its famous final twist, this twist isn't only brilliantly unexpected, but it gives us the neck-prickly feeling that nothing in the world is exactly as it seems. A plot twist this neat inspires a kind of odd reverence. It seems to open up the world rather than close it down. Which is why so many people haven't ruined the movie for their friends by giving it away. One of the best things about these current horror movies is that they're so pleasingly low-tech. Only The Haunting was laden with special effects, and it was a flop, a cheesy, overpriced carnival ride that didn't scare or excite anyone. In contrast, neither Blair Witch nor Sixth Sense use any effects at all. Instead, they treat their story with an earthbound gravity that only makes the unearthly stuff stronger. The same is largely true of Stir of Echoes, which has a few effects, but in its best moments does something exhilarating. It makes us feel that the world is a far richer and riskier place than we thought, that the world is inhabited by more souls than we ever dreamed.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Chirac and Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web at worldwildlife.org. From Hancher Auditorium at the University of Iowa, presenting the Millennium Festival of the Arts beginning this week in Iowa City. uiowa.edu/TildaHancher. And from Dell Publishing, publishers of Cotterskill Falls by Allegra Goodman, a novel about faith, families, and tradition. Available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The next Fresh Air, The Sidewalks of New York. We meet composer and pianist Ori Kane. His new CD celebrates the songs from turn-of-the-century New York City. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.